He's been seen on CNBC, the Fox News Channel, and the Fox Business Channel. His articles can be found on MarketWatch, Seeking Alpha, TheStreet.com, and many other places. He's the author of the weekly Best Stocks Now newsletter and the inventor of the Best Stocks Now app. He's president of Gunderson Capital Management. Here is professional money manager, Bill Gunderson.
And welcome to the Wednesday. It is the midweek edition, the February 11th edition of the Best Stocks Now show with professional money manager Bill Gunderson, president of Gunderson Capital Management. I'm here with Barry Kite, our chartered financial analyst. The markets, they're giving up a little bit of the gains, but we're still up in the green right now after a kind of a shocking, surprisingly shocking jobs report that kind of came out of nowhere. The Dow right now is up 82 points. It was up 250 not long ago, so there is a little profit taking here. But we're at 50,270. The NASDAQ was up quite a bit more. Now it's up just 13 points, but it's at 23,116. The S&P, 6,956. It's up 14 points right now. Small caps are up a third of a percent. And one of the problems is good news is bad news, especially for the bond market. We've got a kind of a spike in interest rates today. We're back up to 4.19, which is still good. We were at 4.35 there for quite a while, and we've come down from there. Gold is up 1%. Crude oil is up 2.6, a little bit of life in crude oil this year. Silver's up 4.4%, and Bitcoin is down 2,057 to 66,368. So welcome to today's Best Stocks Now show with professional money manager Bill Gunderson. And Barry, the big surprise this morning, I didn't know we were getting a jobs. What was it? Was that the non-farm payrolls report on a Wednesday?
Yeah, it was weird because it had been delayed, and so it was a handful of days delayed from release, so that's why we're getting it. You know, normally we get it on a Friday, unless there's some kind of holiday or federal holiday. But yeah, so we get it today, and I mean, you know, it's 130,000 jobs added. The other backdrop, too, I mean, when you think about it, actually, it's more impressive that we're getting this good jobs number because of the comps. I mean, some of these comps, you go back whenever you've got, you know, legal immigration coming in, right? You got more, you're just naturally going to have more added jobs, right, as you have more more people, humanity, inside the country. And so, you know, I was listening to someone who's talking about from a statistics standpoint, it's even stronger than it appears.
Yeah, that's true. And, it, you know, the what the word that Seeking Alpha uses is non-farm payrolls growth shocks to the upside in January and unemployment slips to 4.3%. So, well, you know what? That's going to kill any chance of a rate cut at the next Fed meeting, which we weren't really expecting anyways, unless inflation starts to rear its or inflation drops considerably between now and then. But, you know, that's been the one of the knocks on Trump has been the weak jobs numbers that we've seen recently. And this one kind of turns that all around. So anyways, we'll see if this is just an anomaly. But it is lifting the markets. They were up more right at the start, and there has been some selling into this rally. But we still are up. Yesterday we had kind of a nondescript day in the market. I think it was probably waiting for this jobs report. The 10-year closed way down at 4.15 yesterday, and, of course, it's up today, 4.19, and that's because of, you know, probably holding the Fed at bay. They likely will not do anything now, which they weren't expected to anyways, unless there was a super weak jobs report, then maybe that would have spurred them on. Bitcoin.
Yeah, it moved from, you know, just yesterday, it moved, you know, there was like, I don't know, maybe a 20% chance that there might be a cut in February, and that's moved to 5% now in one day. So basically killed any chance of a potential rate cut in February. We weren't expecting one anyway, but any chance that there was of one at the next meeting, it looks like it may be on hold for the moment.
Yes, we're going to have to wait until his guy gets in there. It sounds like no hope with Powell
wait
at
for
the
Kevin.
Helm. Well, Bitcoin has dropped below technical support again. It remains weak, despite Michael Saylor saying that he's going to buy all the Bitcoin he can forever and ever and ever. And it just remains weak. What can I say? The sentiment against it, that's the problem. When investors and traders lose confidence in an asset class, doesn't matter if it's software, it doesn't matter if it's gold, it doesn't matter if it's silver, it doesn't matter if it's Bitcoin. You've got all these people that want out. They just want out. And any kind of rally you see in it, you get the sell-offs. And that continues to happen in Bitcoin. Even though the bulls, I read that the whales are back. A lot of the Bitcoin whales are back buying Bitcoin. But I don't know. I think that when it comes to the ETFs and the retail investors, they just don't have much appetite for it right now. Now, Robinhood, they're down today because of their crypto exposure. But they remain very bullish on Bitcoin. They say we're moving toward a world where crypto is actually more than an asset class. It's a foundational technology, which is the blockchain that's going to underlie the trading of all assets. That comes from Vlad Tenev, the CEO over at Robinhood. But, you know, the fact of the matter is you look at the chart and that chart remains very, very weak right now. The House approves a bipartisan housing bill. Well, they're working on it and they're actually working together on this. Both sides recognize that it's difficult for the average person out there, young couple, to be able to afford a home. And it's a couple of things, you know. The supply is also a problem. There's not enough supply of inexpensive homes. So they are working together to get a unified bill to President Trump's desk soon. Housing for the 21st Century Act that aims to increase housing supply and home ownership. And, of course, they've thrown around a lot of ideas about making your mortgage portable, making your mortgage assumable. But, anyways, they've got to reconcile these two bills that they're working on. But it looks like something's going to happen, including 38 provisions that would remove regulatory barriers for housing development. That's always been an issue. In San Diego and in California, it was almost impossible. You know, it was very difficult.
Well, you got federal, state, OSHA, municipalities, regulations. Yeah, I mean,
yeah, and you had the Coastal Commission there in California,
that'll do it. Yeah, that'll do it too.
But anyway,
historical societies, obviously,
and some endangered lizard. You know, we can't hurt the habitat of the lizards.
Salamander.
It was all kinds of things. We fought it ever since, you know, growing up in San Diego. It was a fight to build new homes, and of course, a lot of a new home, a lot of the cost in there is all of the costs that it takes in the permitting process and getting the approvals and getting it past all these different commissions and everything. Last time I heard, it was about $50,000 was in a price of a home in California, just the regulatory hurdles that they had to get through. So anyways, there's hope. We'll see. There a lot of irons in the fire. Trump keeps a lot of irons in the fire. I will say that. There's a lot of spinning plates out there. And one of those is trying to make housing more affordable and more accessible to the average young couple, new married couple out there. We've got also J.P. Morgan is out with their target price on the S&P 500. Of course, Trump's target price was 100,000 on the Dow by the time he leaves office. J.P. Morgan's a little bit more tamped down than that, but they're see 8,000. They see S&P topping 8,000. Well, you can look at I've been at right around 8,000 for a long, long time with my S&P 500 target. That gives us pretty good upside potential. Consider we're at 6,900 right now. To go to 8,000 would be, what, 15-16% move. Even J.P. Morgan, even Jamie Dimon is growing increasingly optimistic about the stock market's prospects. Why? Earnings, earnings, earnings. We'll be right back.
I'll be gone 500 miles when the day is done.
Of today's Best Stocks Now show, well, we got a slew of earnings coming in here today, and you know, that's when you take a look at why JP Morgan is all of a sudden getting more bullish on the market. It's because earnings continue to be very good. I've talked about, you know, how this earnings season is going. We've got about 60% in now, and those estimates for this year just keep going up. And a J.P. Morgan is saying that we could get another year of double-digit growth in earnings, and that would make for, I think, several years in a row. You got to go way back to find this many sequential years in a row of double-digit earnings growth. And again, that, in my book, is the biggest driver of the market. That's what's driving it higher. They look for one earnings rate or a one interest rate cut by mid-year, which I think is about right. Maybe by July, maybe by June 30th, we'll get one rate cut. We're going to go over earnings coming in from Ford. Cisco is going to report tonight. We've had Shopify come in. We've had a few others that we will go through. And earnings season, we're right. I would say most of the big guys now, the Microsofts of the world, have reported. We have a new article out today on Seeking Alpha. So far, Barry, I'm delivering on my my goal and promise to try to deliver 2 to 3 articles per week out there on Seeking Alpha. And we cover them all, the duds. I think it's just as important, especially on the widely held stocks, which a lot of people on Seeking Alpha, 20 million people visit Seeking Alpha during the course of a month. It is one of the biggest websites out there for financial news and for retail investors. And, you know, I like to give my opinions out there and justify them with the backup statistics and numbers that back up my thesis and my conclusion on any given stock. And I think it's important to make those investors aware of the soggy stocks that they more than likely, you know, are interested in, the AT&Ts of the world. I think it's just important to do that as it is to bring their attention to what we, because so you can contrast one against another.
Well, and dodging the duds can be just as important as finding the winners.
That's right.
Right, I mean.
So. And today we covered one of our favorite stocks as they reported recently. It's a big player in AI, and I thought it was a good time for an update after their earnings, after their capital spending plans, etc. And we give our latest take on the company formerly known as Facebook, now known as Meta. And I made the point that it is true, Wall Street kind of wrote off Meta there for a while, like he was lost in the metaverse, right?
Well, and we always, yeah, and we always joke around, too, that you know, the one thing that Republicans and Democrats can agree on is that they don't like Zuckerberg. And so, I mean, you can tell the multiple for Meta, you know, it shows, I think, kind of the disdain for you know, that company that even though everyone uses some form or fashion of it. But
yeah. Well, yeah, 3.5 billion people, that's half the planet.
I mean, what's the, I mean, you know the forward P.E. ratio. It's
20. 19. It's 19.
Yeah,
it's a 19 forward P.E., which is less than Procter & Gamble.
I was going to say, I was literally typing in P.G. right now.
Yeah.
PG,
what
is
forward P.E. on Procter?
22.8.
22. What's Coca-Cola? K.O.
Right.
It's got to be up there around 20 or so.
Yeah, and that one's 23.7.
There you go. And we're at 19 on Meta. That's an anomaly for me. That's an opportunity, okay? Whether the market agrees with me or not, you have to cut through that dislike for Facebook and for Zuckerberg himself. Canary Capital. I've never heard of them. I don't know if they're just a canary in the coal mine here. They see Bitcoin sliding to 50,000. It will mark, they say that 2026 will mark the bear leg of Bitcoin's four-year cycle. I'm not a big cycle guy myself. Just when you think you've got a cycle, the cycle doesn't work anymore.
Well,
that's what I have found to be the case. You know, the Elliott wave and this kind of thing.
It's correlation. Yeah, the problem is it's correlation versus causation, right? It's kind of like how we were talking about the years that the NFC wins the Super Bowl, the market does, you know, 3% better than when the AFC does it. And obviously that's not, there's no causation there. It's pure correlation.
Yeah. So, but anyways, they see it going to 50,000. That's all I know is I see a very, very weak asset class, very weak. And any kind of a rally, you have overhead supply that wants out. They use those opportunities to get out.
And the interesting thing about Bitcoin is if somebody says it's going to 50,000 or if somebody says it's going to 120,000, I mean, we still don't really have much of an opinion on it because who knows what it's going to, right? There's no way to really
stick your finger in the wind and guess which way it's going to go. Yeah. India keeps its e-cigarette ban on, which is a blow to Philip Morris. You know what? I'm just not a fan. I think the cigarette stocks long, long ago. It's just an uphill battle. Smoking hasn't been good for people's health. It's been hazardous to your health. And I think it's not a very good investment either. But widely held. Another stock that is in a lot of portfolios that I see from the big wirehouse firms. One of the cities we're heard in is Columbus, Ohio, and not too far south from Columbus is Piketon, Ohio. That's where they're going to build a uranium plant expansion. Centrist Energy, that's LEU, one of the biggest uranium companies out there, said Wednesday that Fluor will be its partner in procurement and construction for the multi-billion dollar expansion of its uranium enrichment capacity in Piketon, Ohio. Well, I think of Iran and their enrichment facilities deep under the ground and all this and that. But under a multi-year contract, Fluor will lead engineering design of the expanded capacity in Ohio. Uranium is becoming a very important piece of the AI puzzle. Palo Alto is in focus. They closed their deal with CyberArk today. I'm not a fan of Palo Alto stock, PANW, but that deal is done. We'll take a look at earnings when we come back as several big companies have weighed in with their quarterly earnings reports. We'll be right back.
Just don't understand anymore. Well, the top brass don't like him talking so much, and he won't play what they say to play.
This is Bill Gunderson. Thank you for tuning in to today's Best Stocks Now, Best Inverse Funds Now show. I put several hours of research in during the wee hours of the morning each day to bring you the very best cutting-edge stories that I can. To get 2 free weeks of my newsletter, go to GundersonCapital.com. To talk to us about our fee-based only money management services, call us at 855-611-BEST. Now, back to the second half of the show.
Welcome back here to the second half of today's Best Stocks Now show. Well, one of the stocks in the news and our show, one of our big audiences is in the Detroit Bloomfield Hills area. And a lot of people, most everybody we meet with back there when we're there, Barry, seems to be tied to the auto industry. A big majority of them in one way or another. And, of course, Ford stock, which they have had their issues over the years. It was $3 a share back in 2020 during COVID, and now it's $13.74 per share. The stock is actually up 1% as they did exceed their expectations, but their sales were $45 billion this quarter versus $48 billion last comparable quarter last year. So their sales were down 5%. Their earnings, however, were only 13 cents per share, which a little bit better than expected, but they made 39 cents per share a year ago. That's down 67%, yet the stock is up 1.1% today. But all in all, look, an investment in Ford over the last 10 years, you've made 7.2% per year. And that includes the last 12 months, which have been way outside of normal. And I think there was a lot of excitement that Ford was backing out of the EV and writing off a lot of things and kind of cleaning house. And actually, over the last 12 months, the stock's up 58%, which is very unusual for Ford, which right now, let's just contrast this. This has always blown me away. Ford is $54 billion in market cap, $54 billion. Tesla is $1.58 trillion.
Okay. Wow.
And you say, how can that be? Well, Tesla trades at 255 times earnings. Ford trades at 12 times earnings. So, I mean, if you put the two side by side, it makes no sense that Ford is so cheap and trades at such a low multiple. But historically, I mean, it's traded in single-digit multiple range, and they don't have a front man at Ford like Tesla has in Elon Musk, and they don't have humanoid robots coming along in the background, and they're not wanting to build AI centers on the moon, which Elon's talking about today. So the discrepancy between the two stocks is enormous. Does that say that, yeah, I'd be buying Ford here? No. You know what? It's a heavy cyclical, very inconsistent earnings, high cost, fierce competition. And the results, has it been worth the risk over the years? Over the last 5 years, you've made 8.5%, while the S&P has been 15.5%. And over the last 3 years, you've made 8.6%, while it's been 23.4%. And you take away this big performance over the last 12 months, which has been due to a lot of factors that are probably not sustainable. You've had very dismal returns in Ford. And yet, you know, I have people that will transfer in an account and they'll tell me, don't sell my Ford. They see, you know, they're beholden to the stock, you know, whether it's sentimental or maybe they had a grandfather that worked there or whatever. It doesn't hold up well in a bear market. In the last bear market, 08 and 09, Ford was down 80%. While the S&P was down 54.5%. And if we do a valuation on Ford, the growth rate is really, is it going to be 5%, 8%, 9%? I'm being fairly generous with my growth rate. I get 70% upside potential, and I think that is really generous, really, really, really generous. All in all, I think you can expect 7, 6, 8% a year with a lot of volatility along the way and choppiness and whatnot. So, I mean, I just can't ever see us owning Ford. We do own their bonds, though, right? Or is it Ford bonds that we own?
Yeah, we owned one from, I don't know, we've had it for a long time, but it was a high yielding bond. I think at the time, I want to say the coupon's around 8.5 maybe.
And has that thing, did it finally mature? I can't remember.
No, nah, it's still going. It was actually a longer dated name, longer dated bond, whenever, you know, back when yields were much lower. So
just give a real simple explanation of why we would buy an 8%. You do a yield to worst calculation.
Right.
Describe that.
Yeah, so the neat thing about bonds in general is it's very mathematical. So when you go into it, when you purchase a bond, at least initially, you know, okay, if this company sticks around and pays you back at the end of the period, right, then here's what your return will be over that at that period. And we call that yield to worst, or you could, you know, some folks will call it yield to maturity or yield to call. We look at yield to worst, and so whenever we buy a bond, you know, hey, worst comes to worst, we have to hold this thing to maturity. Here's what it's going to pay out.
And, yeah.
Obviously, that's going to be a function, you know, of the, you know, coupon. It's primarily a function of the price that you pay for the bond, right? And so that's where, when you talk about the certainty, right, of bonds, like I said, as long as the company is there to pay your principal back in the end, you know, mathematically, you know what to expect.
Yes, and that takes away the interest rate risk if you plan on holding it to maturity. And there's the difference. There's the big difference between owning a bond fund where you have a lot of interest rate risk.
And a lot of turnover inside the fund itself.
Right? I just don't like bond funds, and there's got to be trillions and trillions of dollars in bond funds. I see these ads all the time, Vanguard, and it shows all these people sitting behind computers watching the markets trade and everything, and how they have institutional quality bond funds. Well, I would just challenge you to look on the app and pull up a big bond fund, AGG, for instance, which is the aggregate bond fund. Or you can do a bond, B-O-N-D is another one, and you'll find like you're lucky to find 2% overall returns over the last decade because of, you know, you've been fighting interest rates, and that's bond funds. Whereas if you take an individual bond that you hold to maturity, to me, that just makes so much more sense than owning a bond fund. But there's your most widely held asset class, I would say, out there is, you know, because with the asset allocation strategies that most firms employ onto their investors, 40 to 50% of your portfolio would be in bond funds. That's just the way it is. And bond funds, I have a real hatred and dislike, because of the returns.
Yeah.
It's like having a guy in your lineup that bats 198 year after year. Does that help me? No. It drags me down. It drags the rest of the team down. That's my take on bond funds, and I'm very outspoken on that. And yet, it's probably the most used tool, other than ETFs, and, you know, big ETFs that track massive baskets of stocks. How are you, you're not going to get any alpha out of that. You're the benchmark that everybody else, you know, is out there to beat. So I just can't see. I think it's the most overused, and it's a big cash cow for these companies that manage these bond funds because they charge a management fee inside those bond funds. And at the end of the day, there's not much left over for the individual investor. So you just look at your statement when you get it. How much do you own? And there's, they come in all flavors, and that's also part of an asset allocation. You're going to have a ton of short-term bonds that are paying 1% or 2% short-term paper. Then you're going to have some intermediate, they're going to layer them, intermediate-term bonds. You're going to have some long-term bonds. You might have some corporate bonds. You might have some U.S. treasuries. You might have some emerging market debt. But it all adds up to very mediocre returns over time. We'll be right back. Welcome back here to the final segment of today's Best Stocks Now show. Now, this next stock that I'm going to talk about is Robinhood, which is an excellent example. You know, it's one thing to know when to buy. It's another thing to know when to sell. And I'm going to use Robinhood as an example. We did very well with Robinhood in 2025. We bought it on March the 12th. I know we owned it in our ultra growth portfolio, and I'm going to look and see if we owned it in our premier growth because it is a large cap stock these days. I mean, it's become pretty much the de facto.
And it was getting larger as we were holding it.
Yeah. We owned it, I guess, just in the ultra growth, but we had a pretty big position. We bought it on March the 12th at $39 per share, and it went on a major run. And I remember it going from a 3 or 4% position to an 8%, and pretty soon it became a 10 or 12% position in that portfolio. And along the way, you know, I did some selling, but the biggest thing that started to happen to Robinhood was the chart started to break down in the early fall of last year in October, in the October time frame. We sold half of it at $132. I cut it in half. So I took a 15% position down to like a 7% position. And then I sold the rest at $125 when the chart continued to weaken. Was that a good choice? Well, it's at $76 today. So, you know, it's down another, what, 45% from where we sold it. And the chart has only gotten worse and worse and worse. And one of the problems that Robinhood has right now is his exposure to crypto. And that was the thing I think that started to cause people to second guess Robinhood when they started to start talking about the sports betting, the prediction markets, and the exposure to crypto. We have never gotten back into the stock, and we've avoided a $50 sell-off. We are out of it $50 higher. Now, eventually it may land in a spot where it becomes attractive again, but I look at the P.E. ratio right now, it's at 42. Well, it was at 100 at one time. It got to 101, the P.E. ratio on Robinhood. It's now a $68 billion company. But it got up to $130 billion in market capitalization. That's a large cap stock. That's good old Vlad, Vlad Tenev, who gets a lot of press. He's not an Elon Musk, but maybe in his little industry, in that space, him, Robinhood, and Interactive Brokers are probably the two brokerage firms of choice for the trading on your iPhone crowd, let's call it, all right? And, you know, Robinhood has no minimum. I've had people ask me, Bill, how do I invest in, you know, in the markets? Well, look, start with buying a few shares of a really good stock and just keep adding and build a portfolio over time.
Yeah, they might sell fractional shares there too. I know in some names, some of these companies do now. So, you know,
yeah,
you know, if you want a piece of Booking.com that's 5,000
yeah.
change, right? Then
now
you,
it does become a problem. I have people transfer fractional like. Someone owns 13.144 shares of something.
It's true.
I guess Schwab doesn't sell the fractional shares. So when I sell the position, the client's left holding like one-tenth of one share. Because they all need to get together, all of these firms, right, and adopt a policy, whether we're going to do fractional shares or not. And then Robinhood has a lot of really strange contracts and whatnot, but you know, their earnings growth, okay, their sales were up 27% year over year. Their earnings were up 22%. That's a huge drop. That's a big deceleration. You know, they were a triple-digit grower. If I look at the three prior quarters to that, 106%, 100%, 259%, and then down to 22. And when you start to get that deceleration going from triple-digit growth now to just 22% growth, that's a massive deceleration. That's putting on the brakes is what that's doing, and it's reflected in the charts. Stocks not only follow earnings, but they follow earnings expectations, and deceleration is a bad thing. If a stock's been averaging 40% growth, you know, in the last several quarters, and all of a sudden it drops to 10, we've seen quite a few examples of that this quarter, that's not good. And if you look at that chart on Robinhood, that's a terrible chart. At some point, will it bottom and maybe be an attractive entry point again? Well, it's possible. I still think that they're a market leader in the space that they're in. And it's hard to sneeze at a $68 billion company that started from nothing in 2021. So anyways, Robinhood, back in 2021, got up to $85. Now here it is 5 years later, and it's below that level it hit in its first year as a publicly traded company. So we do not own Robinhood. I'm not surprised by this sell-off in Robinhood today. And, you know, maybe I think in the I am dusting off my old book and going to get it out, a new issue of it this year sometime. And maybe we'll do a whole chapter or two on when to sell. Oh, it's fun to buy, Barry. It's easy to pull the trigger on a buy. It's much more difficult. And I would say, even more important, knowing when to sell than when to buy. Number one, admitting when you've made a mistake and not riding a buy into the ground, which there's a few money managers that I know out there that run ETFs that are infamous for riding stocks into the ground. No, you have to have some kind of net underneath the higher wire you're walking on in case you're wrong and slip and make a mistake. And it's all it takes is one really, really big loser, not only to kill your confidence, but to kill your portfolio. So that's why they call it money management. All right. Anyways, if you'd like to get 4 weeks to the newsletter, go to GundersonCapital.com and learn along with the trading and buying and selling that I do and the portfolios that I run. And if you say, you know, I don't have time to be on this all the time, we manage money here for a living. Give us a call. Set up an appointment. 855-611-BEST. 855-611-BEST.
This show is not a solicitation to buy or sell any securities. Bill Gunderson or clients of Gunderson Capital Management may have long or short positions in stocks mentioned during the show. Past performance is not indicative of future performance. Gunderson Capital Management is a fee-based registered investment advisory firm. All accounts are held at Charles Schwab. Schwab is a member of SIPC and FINRA.